ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He was the man who stole the plans for the atomic bomb. A brilliant physicist, a devoted communist. A spy hiding inside the most secret project on Earth. This is the story of Klaus Fuchs, a man who believed he could serve two masters, science and the Soviets. To hear it, search for The Bomb on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone once again. Great to be with you for a conversation this week about fascism. Fascism in the 20th century, fascism in the 21st century, fascism through the eyes of a mid-20th century philosopher whose ideas today are a little underappreciated. And that's a shame because his work provides very useful tools for understanding and dealing with some of our most urgent contemporary problems. Fascism is one of those words that get thrown around these days in such a way as to wear them out a little bit. If you spend enough time on social media, you'll know that fascist often just means that person on the political right who I don't happen to like. But fascism isn't just a buzzword. It's a real political phenomenon with identifiable elements. The belief in the supremacy of the nation, the glorification of a mythic national past or destiny, a cult of charismatic leadership, a hostility toward democracy, the glorification of war and the legitimization of violence as a political tool, a certain commitment to politics as theatre with rallies and marches and symbols and slogans and so on. That's fascism, and while we recognise it from some of the darkest days of the 20th century in Europe, there's a growing body of concerned opinion that we are seeing it again today in the USA, unfolding under this second presidency of Donald J. Trump. And the philosopher I mentioned a minute ago, who saw fascism up close during the Second World War, is Albert Camus. Born in French Algeria in 1913, died in a car accident in rural France in 1960, author of such philosophical works as The Myth of Sisyphus and a number of very famous novels, including The Plague, my guest this week believes that Albert Camus would not have been entirely surprised to witness the turn to the extreme political right happening in many parts of the world today. And he sees Camus as someone who deserves close attention from anyone looking to understand any number of our current predicaments, from political to environmental. Matthew Sharp is a lecturer and researcher in the School of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne, and he's the author of a brand new book titled Why Albert Camus Matters. The major period of creative output that Camus had from the late 1930s through the Second World War and into the 1950s, this was a time in Europe of incredible upheaval and calamity and uncertainty. And the argument running through your book is that our world today faces upheavals and calamities and uncertainties that are in some ways analogous to those that Camus was witnessing and experiencing. Can we begin by sketching that out a little? Like, what are some of the contemporary issues and challenges that Camus might have recognised in his day, or at least not been surprised by?
So I think the first one is really widespread social alienation, or what the sociologists called anomie. People being increasingly faced with a world that they don't feel like they necessarily belong in, or that the future belongs to them, which is, of course, what Camus raises in the first of his major philosophical essays, The Myth of Sisyphus. In the book, I go through a number of really telling statistics, particularly from America, but also around the world, about social isolation, loneliness, perceptions of the future being very dour, even amongst the young, and research in America on what are called deaths of despair, alcohol, drugs, suicide, the numbers of which are troublingly high. So I think the first issue that Camus raises is the issue of nihilism that I think hasn't really gone away, which is the concern that people have that they no longer belong in the world and they can no longer make sense of their existences. But I think you mention socio-political crises and even, of course, war, which we face in Ukraine and Israel and so on. I think we're in a period of democratic, if not collapse, of withdrawal. We're in a period where the radical right has regained legitimacy, and even in places, including arguably the United States, has even gained power. Camus was responding to all of these things, particularly after 1942, he became involved in the French Resistance. And then his second book, his second major philosophical book, that is, The Rebel, is a response to fascism and Stalinism, really. So I think Camus' time and ours have unfortunate echoes. Our time has unfortunate echoes of Camus' time. And so that was how I wanted to frame the idea of why Camus matters, which is the subject matter of the book. My argument is that Camus matters, first of all, because he was responding to problems whose legatees we arguably face politically and culturally. And I also think, as I think we'll discuss, that he has a unique voice as well, philosophically, which is often underappreciated, which I think speaks particularly pertinently to a number of our debates, including, in fact, debates around ecology. He believes that the modern West has lost balance in terms of its relationship with the natural world. And he's writing on this in the 40s and into the 50s. And he thinks that that loss of balance with the natural world is not unrelated to the kinds of excessive and even totalitarian political forms that were rampaging through Europe at that time.
He was a singular philosopher in his day too, wasn't he? Because you write about how his intellectual path was not shaped by the scholarly debates that were swirling around him at the time. What did shape his intellectual path? Like, who or what was influencing him in his work?
So, yeah, Camus was, as some listeners I'm sure will know, he was a French-Algerian. His mother was illiterate. All of his family was illiterate. Albert was the first Camus who could read. He was discovered at school and then mentored into university in Algiers. And he came under the tutelage of a philosopher by the name of Jean Grenier, who is in himself a really interesting figure. But in any case, Camus was reading through Grenier and into his diplôme thesis. He was reading ancient Greek texts, tragedies in particular. He was involved in a theatre group that performed some Aeschylus. He was certainly reading Nietzsche. But he was also reading early Christian sources, Augustine. His thesis is on ancient Greek and early Christian responses to the problem of evil. So he's coming into Paris, where he arrives in 42, not as somebody from the Metropolitan University system. He certainly read some Husserl, some Heidegger, who appear in the myth of Sisyphus. But, you know, he often will say in interviews that I wasn't raised on modern German philosophy, post-Kantian philosophy. My first inspirations came from the Greeks. These were Camus' formative influences rather than Kant, Hegel, and so on. So, yeah, I mean, he's coming into the Parisian milieu where he meets Sartre and others as an outsider, and he's almost treated as something of a curiosity or a novelty in that context. Yeah, his intellectual background is importantly different, although he's often assimilated to the existentialist movement. This is an assimilation that he always pushed back against. He didn't think that it was an accurate description.
Mm. In some ways, I think the description is understandable. I mean, he's primarily associated with the philosophy of absurdism, which some people take to be of the same family as existentialism. Some say that he was a nihilist. You know, the world is absurd, therefore it has no meaning. Of course, Camus rejected both of those labels. He said he was neither an existentialist nor a nihilist. So how should we understand the idea of the absurd in his thinking? If it's not existentialism, if it's not nihilism, what is it?
Camus thinks that the human mind has limits. We want a total explanation of life, the universe and everything, if you like. But unfortunately, or fortunately, it's just the way that it is. The final words, as he says, the final secrets seem to be unavailable to us without making what he calls a kind of leap, which he calls a leap of philosophical suicide. The absurd, he says, is not in the world. It's not the senselessness of the world. We don't know enough to say that the world is senseless, he believes. The absurd is a confrontation between that desire for a total explanation and a world which finally resists that desire. And so there's a confrontation between this desire and its unfulfillment. And it's that confrontation that he says is the absurd. And so the absurd is not identified with nihilism, which Camus believes is the belief that nothing has any meaning. And Camus simply thinks that we don't know enough to say that, if you like. We can't get absolute meaning, but neither can we get absolute non-meaning out of any of this. What is interesting is what's in between, which is, you know, the human endeavor to create meaning and to find meaning within the limits of our understanding, where a nihilist for Camus leaps into a total explanation. It's like a symmetrical theology. The theologian will say there is a God, this is the meaning of life, existence and everything, and it's a total explanation. The nihilist will say nothing has any meaning, and it's an equally totalizing position for Camus. In between, there is some things have meaning. They certainly have meaning relative to us, and perhaps even there's certainly order and structure in the world, which gives it intelligibility. And so there's lots to be done, if you like, in between the absolute yes and the absolute no. And that's what he's interested in pursuing.
Yeah, the absolute yes is an interesting one, because that's one that philosophers, of course, will constantly grasp for, the sort of totalizing explanation of everything. And Camus actually calls that suicide. He calls that philosophical suicide. What's the connection there with suicide for him?
So the myth of Sisyphus is about suicide, first of all, in a real and physical sense. And obviously the idea of a leap can connote a certain way of doing that. The idea of a philosophical leap is when the human mind confronts the ultimate unintelligibility of aspects of the universe, it can sit with that, which Camus thinks is the honest and lucid thing to do, or it can leap out of that, the discomfort that creates, that I have this desire that's unfulfilled, and it can leap into there is a system. And in fact, the appearance of unintelligibility is now resolved, and away we go. We have a Spinoza's or Hegelian system, for example. And as I say, the irrationalist leap out of that is to say, well, the world has no meaning. There's an unintelligibility, and it kind of absolutizes that unintelligibility. Now that's the meaning of life, is this kind of completely unintelligible universe. And in fact, for Camus, increasingly into the later 40s, the world has an order, a beauty, a structure. It's just not made to measure for the human. We're not the center of it. You know, the world has an order, and that order includes plagues. It includes pestilences. It includes tsunamis. But there is an order, and it is intelligible. It has meaning. And indeed, Camus thinks that it has beauty. The same nature that sends tsunamis also gives us landscapes and sunsets and epic places that we can visit, like Kakadu, for example, where I was recently.
It's an interesting way of looking at it, because it's not a sort of it's not a resolution into nature is nurturing, nature is caring, but it's not a resolution in the other direction of the sort of the freezing, meaningless universe. And yet the absurd requires a response. And this is the problem, I guess, how should one respond to the absurd confrontation without falling into nihilism? There's a sort of a progressive step, if you like, in what Camus calls rebellion or revolt. What does he mean by that?
Rebellion emerges in the myth of Sisyphus already, or revolt, as an authentic way, if you like, to respond to the absurd. And in that book, I think he's talking about revolting against the temptation, or rebelling against the temptation to reach for a total explanation, for closure. But then with The Rebel, the book Man in Revolt of 52, this becomes the central notion. And revolt for Camus is something that involves both a no and a yes. He's very much a thinker of balance and two-sidedness. So evidently, if I'm rebelling against a piece of legislation that I find unjust, I'm saying no to that. But what's interesting about Camus is that he argues that every no, if you like, must presuppose some prior yes, by which he means that if I'm rebelling against a piece of legislation, I'll be doing it at least implicitly in the name of some value, which I may not have even articulated, but which will have to be there, which explains my rejection. It will probably involve some notion of justice, for example, in this case. And so the notion of revolt for Camus becomes central, because he believes that the modern age is an age of revolt. It's an age of revolt against Christian theology and against the kinds of regimes that Christian theology had sanctified. But he argues that the very kinds of injustice that motivated a lot of the modern rebellion in figures like Voltaire and so on, against injustice perpetrated in the name of absolute theology, unfortunately, in the modern age, these very kinds of injustices get reproduced by secular ideologies, which license murder, enslavement, and deceit. So fascism on the right, forms of Marxism-Leninism on the left. And so you have this paradox of a modern age founded on revolt against the injustices committed in the name of God, which ends up reproducing the same kinds of injustices, but now in the names of secular ideologies, you know, the production of the master race, the end of history, and the dictatorship of the proletariat.
Yeah, and in a lot of this, of course, he's a philosophical fellow traveller with Nietzsche, who had a sort of a complicated and fascinating position with regard to nihilism, the death of God, the loss of meaning in 19th century Europe. Camus was an admirer of Nietzsche, not an uncritical admirer. How did he read Nietzsche when it came to these ideas of nihilism and revolt in the face of the absurd?
Yeah, so Camus is an admirer of Nietzsche. He literally died with a copy of The Gay Science in the car. But as you say, in The Rebel, he's not uncritical of Nietzsche. I think that's sometimes underappreciated how critical he actually is. He thinks that Nietzsche is the inescapable, most lucid diagnostician of the problem of nihilism in the modern world. But for Camus, it is a problem, whereas Nietzsche argues that we need to, in a sense, fully embrace nihilism, or at least a certain cohort of people who will become the progenitors of the Overman are going to embrace nihilism actively, embrace the innocence of becoming, which means loving everything, loving fate, and loving everything that occurs up to and including the seemingly most cruel and abhorrent. But Camus' position in The Rebel is that once we go beyond Nietzsche as a diagnostician of nihilism, of the problem of nihilism, which is, as I say, a problem for Camus, it's not something to be celebrated. He argues that Nietzsche's solution is really, well, ethically problematic insofar as if we accept with Nietzsche the need to wholly rid ourselves of all transcendent ideals and to wholly embrace this sad and suffering world in its innocence, then we become committed to affirming a lot of things that are deeply problematic. I mean, do we want to affirm Auschwitz, for example? This is Camus' kind of position on Nietzsche, is that the absolute yes, so Nietzsche absolutizes a certain kind of yes, and a yes to this world and everything that it includes, including relations of hierarchy, power, exploitation, and cruelty. And Camus doesn't want to go there with him because he thinks that revolt involves both a yes and the ability to say no. So Camus certainly doesn't think that Nietzsche is reducible to his fascist reproduction, but he does argue in The Rebel that the fascists could find and did find justifications, including for their most abhorrent actions, in some of Nietzsche's claims.
On ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Matthew Sharp. We're talking about the mid-20th century French philosopher and novelist Albert Camus and the relevance of Camus' work to many of the 21st century predicaments we find ourselves in today. Why Albert Camus Matters is the title of Matt's new book. More details at the end of the show. Well, let's talk some more about fascism and the ways in which Camus' work can shed light on what many alarmed observers are calling the rise of neo-fascism in many parts of the world today, including, of course, the United States of America. You mentioned in the introduction to your book that you started writing the book on November the 5th, 2024, which was the day of the re-election of Donald Trump to the US presidency. Was that a consciously symbolic act?
Yeah, I mean, it was a combination of chance and then, I guess, deliberate choice. I certainly had been fearful that Mr. Trump would be re-elected. And like many other critics, I'd been increasingly concerned about his rhetoric and language and elements of the MAGA movement, which just inescapably echo precedents that come from the far right in interwar Europe. And it seemed to me that, and I don't think this has been necessarily contradicted, that a second Trump administration would be much more radical and much more untethered than the first, on the basis of the events of January 6, 2021, in which it was pretty clear that Mr. Trump had accepted the possibility of rejecting the democratic process. So if a leader who has shown that willingness is then elected subsequently, I think we have reason to suspect that the democratic processes will be under threat. And as Camus is a pro-democratic theorist, it was a bit of a wake-up call. I think I'd been delaying starting, and I thought, well, you know, to allay depression, if nothing else, I'll get started today.
Camus writes The Rebel in the years immediately following World War II, and in that work he has a chapter titled State Terrorism and Irrational Terror, where he writes about fascism and its various constituent elements and dynamics. What does Camus have to say about fascism? Like, what does he think fascism is?
Well, Camus thinks that fascism is a kind of secularized theology in a way, theology which centers on a charismatic leader who embodies a fictionalized will of the people, but it's undergirded by what he calls an irrational position, an irrationalist position, which is that life is movement, life is struggle. Normative principles are fictions created by human beings in order to try to stabilize what can't be stabilized. And so the title that you mentioned, State Terrorism, is self-explanatory, but irrational terror refers to the embrace of kind of vitalistic philosophies and their vulgarization in the interwar fascist movement. So the leader is the most dynamic, the most vital, the most living kind of sort of embodiment of this kind of supposed truth of existence, which is that reason is very much subordinate, instinct, will, life force, and then, of course, in Nazism, biological racism. These become the founding reference points in terms of fascist thinking about what life is about, the struggle between different life forms in order to achieve domination. And so in Nazism, that takes on an explicitly ethno-racial dimension, which is somewhat less pronounced in Italian fascism, but not absent. So Camus challenges visions of fascism which present it as a kind of hypertrophy, that is a kind of extreme expression of modern scientific rationality or modern technological rationality. So technology is used by the fascists, for example, to kill people in large numbers, but it's being used in the name of an irrationalist philosophy, which is a struggle between the races. So sure, you need a train system and you need carbon monoxide and all of that in order to do what the Nazis did. But why were they doing it? For Camus, the answer has to involve a reference to these kind of irrationalist claims. There are different races, they're in a struggle, the Jews have this position in this ideology and therefore they need to be eliminated. You can't understand fascism, its dynamism, also its appeal, without understanding this romanticization of struggle, of war, of dynamism, of violence, which is at its heart, you know, violence as an expression paradoxically of vitality. The most strong will engage in acts of provocation and domination because that's the exertion of their strength.
And this all feeds on mass appeal too, doesn't it? And it raises the question of what sort of conditions fascism requires in order to take root and grow. And Camus identifies despair, you know, despair among the masses, which I found really interesting when I came to that point in this chapter in the book, because it took me back to the early comments in your book about, in the book about anomie and deaths of despair in the United States. That's a connection that Camus presumably would have made, right?
Yeah, and he talks about the epidemic of suicides after the First World War in Germany. And of course, you had the hyperinflation and you had all sorts of instability, an imposed political system with the reparations and a nation that was humiliated because of its defeat in the First World War, which of course wasn't accepted as a defeat by many millions. So yeah, Camus definitely identifies despair, despair and cynicism, and the two are often linked. You know, if the world's not providing me anything, then what do I have to value? You know, what's worth doing? So fascism has an interesting relationship in Camus' thought with cynicism, which is, you know, obviously the belief that, you know, nothing has any meaning and therefore we should just assert ourselves. We should just kind of struggle with others to get what we can and fulfill as many of our desires as we're able. And I think what Camus writes about cynicism, which I think is very much alive and well today, is really often insightful and disconcerting. You know, he has this book, The Fall, in 1956, which is really a consummately cynical character, this Jean-Baptiste Clemens, who has discovered the truth, as he believes it, that everybody lies, that everything's a con. And so he just openly embraces that and tries to con and lie to everyone he meets. And I think Camus is giving us a portrait of the kind of despairing cynicism that can lead into this idea that life is just a struggle, it's just bleak, that all humane sentiments, things like love, friendship, nobility, beauty, the virtues, they're all a con. You know, they're just words that are used in order to pull the wool over other people's eyes. And what's left then is simply the struggle for existence. It's just mine versus thine, whether on an individual or a collective level. So I think Clemence is, amongst other things, I think there's a number of registers to that book, but I think he's trying to give an inside portrait of the kinds of mindset that can lead people into, for example, far-right ideology.
Well, I don't think we have to look very far to find parallels here with certain aspects of what we see unfolding on the political and the cultural stage in the USA right now. What might a Camusian response to America under Trump 2.0 look like?
I think Camus would be profoundly concerned. I mean, he was as I write about in the book, he was a journalist. He was a great believer in the probity and importance of genuinely independent, fact-based journalism as a necessary contributor to democratic society, while recognizing that journalists get things wrong and that what we call legacy media is not infallible or anything like that. But Camus, in the immediate period after the Second World War, he was associated with a resistance newspaper called Combat. And he writes a series of articles about the importance, as I say, of an independent media. And he even gives advice to journalists as to how they should proceed in terms of identifying sources, informing the readers concerning the reliability or otherwise of sources, the context in which claims are made. But he's already worried in like 46 that money is taking over the French media. And so what you're getting is pictures of pretty girls with low-cut dresses instead of robust, critically self-aware journalism. So the attack that has been so central to the MAGA movement on the mainstream media, the blanket claim that it is wholly fake, I think Camus would, from early on, have been very, very, very concerned about. I mean, the Nazis called the mainstream press the lying press. And that makes its way into some alt-right kind of discourse as well, that idea. But fake news is obviously the term that's come up. And so what Camus would be concerned about is that's another kind of leveling of the playing field. If you can say, well, the mainstream media is kind of all fake, and then you've leveled the ground for openly partisan voices to just enter into the field and present themselves as equally legitimate as the media that might be trying and failing to find the truth, that might be jaundiced, prejudiced, as all humans are, overdetermined by economic and social and political factors, as most human things are, but still trying to do investigative journalism, still trying to hold power to account. Instead, you've got this kind of leveling out where everything becomes just another perspective, you know, another voice. So Breitbart is equivalent to, I don't know, the Sydney Morning Herald or. So, I mean, that's the first of many things I think Camus would say, is that this idea of post-truth, this kind of post-truth thing that people were talking about when Trump came to power, you know, how can this guy who the Washington Post identifies over, I think, 30,000 misleading statements in his first term, how does he kind of get away with it? What's going on there? Have we entered into a world where truth doesn't matter? I think Camus would say, well, if you look at Stalinism, that was a post-truth world as well. How on earth was the ordinary individual under Stalin ever able to establish the truth or otherwise of the claims that were being made by the government? So there's troubling echoes, I think Camus would say, and just at that level. But, you know, more widely, I think all of the features of, or many of the features anyway, of the interwar fascism that Camus identifies in The Rebel, I think are clearly present, at least in elements of the MAGA movement. I think we need to be really careful as we talk about the Trump movement, which has different components, it has different constituencies, but certainly much of the rhetoric, including from Mr. Trump himself, is clearly identifiable with interwar fascism, describing enemies as vermin, as illegitimate, as enemies of the people, and so on and so forth. I think Camus would be really troubled by all of that.
Yeah, there's rhetoric and there's also an aesthetic as well. I've always been very interested in the importance of the aesthetic in fascist movements, fascist politics. And we saw this extraordinary spectacle this week of Pete Hegseth, the US Secretary of War, as he has insisted on calling himself, appearing before the assembled military top brass and staging this highly aestheticized performance. I mean, there's a sense in which Hegseth is a performer. He's a spectacle himself. He's a media guy. He's very into the image. You know, he's got the tattoos. He's all ripped. He's got the tight suits. The way he carries himself with a certain aristocratic contempt, it's all very stylized. Mm. And in his address to the generals this week, we saw him set out an aesthetic ideal or even an aesthetic demand, you know, no more fat guys, no more beards and so on. And it seems like the aesthetic is an underappreciated but definitive aspect of what we're seeing unfold in the USA right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's always fascinating that one of the things that people will say about the troubling history of intellectuals in politics is that, you know, that intellectuals are interested in refined things like art, and fascism is a vulgar popular movement, and therefore how could intellectuals ever get involved in something like fascism? Well, the historical record says that they can do and probably will continue to do. And one of the reasons why is the aesthetic dimension. I mean, Walter Benjamin wrote a very famous article about the fascist aestheticization of politics. And again, I think with the MAGA movement from the start, you've got mass rallies with the music, with the big banners. It's been aestheticized from the start. I mean, Trump himself with his kind of telltale suit and red tie, his kind of orange glow and yellow hair. You know, this is all very much out of the playbook of interwar fascism. And I mean, it's really interesting that Hegseth this week is really presenting a certain kind of ideal of the male warrior. And again, this is really deeply important to those kinds of movements, is this kind of protest masculinity, a reassertion of a sense of traditional masculinity, which leads into the idea that women have kids and men fight. And to be young and virile and a warrior is the ultimate thing for a man to be. And it's extraordinary to see Hegseth making these claims to these four-star generals about exercise and no fat guys, as you say. But it seems to be troublingly echoing this cult of youth, cult of beauty that was a big part of the Hitler movement in Germany, the Mussolini movement in Italy. And the fact that he's called the Secretary of War is also deeply significant. What happened to the Department of Defense? And, you know, his statements that I saw were very much, we've got the biggest, best military. No one else can touch us. So, again, this kind of phallic self-assertion, if you like. We've got the biggest guns and the best weapons. And watch out, you know. The idea that the military might be, for example, engaged in peacekeeping doesn't seem to be high on Hegseth's radar.
Yeah. Well, I guess we come back to that sort of exaltation of spirit and life force and sort of dynamism, you know, where you get that with war, right? Mm-hmm. You don't get that with peace or defense. I guess that's part of the point.
Yeah, and certainly with the interwar stuff, the fascists, like that, if you look at Rick, someone like Ernst Junger, who was a warrior of the First World War, became a really key source for far-right ideas in Germany and elsewhere. When he got back from the war, and his experience was shared by many, peacetime life just looked utterly tawdry, utterly unsatisfactory, you know, a kind of sickening materialist longing for security at all costs without any dignity, compared to the thrill and the exultation of going over the top and kind of facing lines of barbed wire and machine guns. I mean, Junger was, he was an avant-garde in the German army. He was a shock trooper. He was a real kind of McCoy kind of guy. But yeah, his depiction of the peace is one of almost disgust. We've got nothing better to do than make money, you know. And that's the romance and the attraction, I think, to young men as well. You know, this is kind of a... fascism gives you a kind of comic book view of the world. Like, there are these ripped up guys like Hegseth who are fighting wars to protect their culture, their tradition, their heritage, their language, whatever it may be. It's for a lot of young guys, compared to kind of stick a job at McDonald's, that looks pretty good, you know? That's a really exciting kind of vision. And I think we've underestimated after the war because of fascism was discredited so thoroughly, just how seductive this kind of vision can be for people who are facing, will I get a house? Will I get a job? Will girls like me? Answer, you're a warrior.
This is something that Camus has a certain sympathy for, doesn't he? If not sympathy, empathy. I mean, he writes that we need to understand the despair and the enemy that animates that kind of identification, that kind of desire on the part of young men, and not just young men. But I mean, Camus would not be writing off the Marga masses as just sort of stupid and ignorant, I guess, is what we take from that. He would be suggesting a kind of empathy. We need to understand what motivates them if we're going to do anything about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a democracy, the only way back is to win them back. And if you look down upon them and just condemn them, absolutely, of course, you're not going to win them back. You're just going to further polarize things. So, yeah, I mean, Camus does undertake, as you say, a kind of exercise in empathy, which is why I think he tries to get inside the head of this character, Clemence. What is it like to be someone who is just utterly cynical and despairing? And, you know, there are reasons why people are cynical and despairing, socioeconomic reasons, political reasons. There really are all sorts of indices which do indicate that many people in America have been left behind, particularly outside of those metropolitan areas on the coasts. And entire communities have been deracinated, uprooted. And there is certainly an arrogance, I think, particularly amongst the tech elite, about many of these populations. And, you know, if you neglect and shun people, they will probably neglect and shun you back.
Well, you write that Camus matters as more than a critic, but as someone who presents positive ways forward for dark times, including or even especially our present age of ecological emergency. Climate change, of course, was not on Camus' radar or anyone's radar by the time he died in 1960. But what do you think Camus might make of the climate change crisis if he could witness it today? How might he analyse or characterise it?
Well, one of the really interesting things about Camus and this heritage we talked about with Greek thought is that he characterizes Greek thought as overwhelmingly a sort of harmony and balance, including balance with the natural world. He then argues that through Christianity, the Christian heritage, the sources of meaning that people located were either beyond the natural world in God, or in the movement of history, the drama of fall, incarnation, redemption. And this kind of drama of history progressing towards some end, he sees playing out, for example, in forms of Marxism-Leninism. And so we're looking for our meaning in the course of human behaviour, human interaction, the evolution of human societies alone. And he argues that the modern world has largely, and this is in the 40s, embraced ideologies that don't really balance the dimension of our existence, which is tied to non-human nature. So he has this wonderful essay from 1948 called Helen's Exile. And Helen is the symbol of the Greeks, Helen, Hellenes. And she symbolizes natural beauty. And he says, in European novels since Dostoevsky, there are no landscapes. You know, this is really, really significant. Camus sees in the natural world, as I say, an ordered whole, which is not made to measure of human experience in the sense that the natural world can from time to time visit pestilences upon us and so on. But on the other hand, he sees in it a source of beauty and of balance against a one-sided focus on human activity and the human construction of meaning. There is this wider whole, this natural whole that we're able to access, for example, through experiences of beauty with landscapes. And he doesn't think that this is trivial or kind of twee. He thinks that nature is a source of limits, and there's a human nature which is limited. And the problem with the moderns is, as far as Camus is concerned, is we've become excessive. We've shunned those limits. You know, he says, you know, in a drunken sky, we light up what suns we please until the atom bomb, you know, and he's talking about the atom bomb at that point. You know, we've lost what gave permanence to human existence, which includes the ability to contemplate the natural world. And so already, I think in the 40s, although Camus, as you say, doesn't have climate change on his radar, he does have this argument that there's something wrong with the modern world's relationship with the natural world. It's not a question of going back to nature. It's a question of rebalancing. And if we just look at nature as a set of resources to be exploited indefinitely and infinitely, well, he says the limits exist and we're going to find out what they are. And the idea of infinite growth and infinite innovation and infinite kind of change without a kind of stable center is something that Camus finds very, very troubling. And, you know, I think that we still see that imagination operating everywhere, including in the Silicon Valley with the rush to produce technologies whose social and other effects many of the progenitors themselves are uncertain about.
You write that Camus is an underappreciated philosopher today, which seems kind of strange given the conversation we've just been having about the relevance of his work to such urgent present-day concerns. Why do you think he hasn't been more widely acknowledged and appreciated?
I mean, Camus was a writer, a journalist, he was a political man, as well as a philosopher, and he never thought of himself in a sense as a philosopher first. He writes more, I think, for a non-university audience than other more technical philosophers. And I think Camus tends to be dismissed as a kind of a philosopher for first-year students, usually the first 40 pages of The Myth of Sisyphus and the conclusion. But, you know, I think he's very underappreciated insofar as he really does address deep and lasting problems. And he has a surprising range of references. You know, he's really deeply immersed in the Christian tradition. He's really deeply immersed in the Greek philosophical tradition and the Greek tragic tradition. And I think a lot of those references are a little bit foreign to other ways of thinking. That could be another reason why he's underappreciated. But as I say, I think the major reason is, well, Camus is a great writer. Everyone loves The Plague. But, you know, as a philosopher, he's kind of a footnote to Sartre, which he would have hated because he really has strong objections to Sartre's philosophy, you know, this idea of radical freedom. Camus doesn't think we're radically free. There are limits, you know, there are natural limits to what we can and should do. I mean, we can create super machines that can take over us, but should we? Camus would say we're probably violating some kind of a natural limit and the Furies will return, as in the Greek tragedies, to let us know.
I think it's true that everyone loves The Plague. It is an incredible novel, but I wonder if everyone loves The Outsider. That was my introduction to Camus. We all had to read The Outsider in high school and I hated it.
Yeah. Wow.
I didn't enjoy it as a reading experience. I didn't like what we were supposed to take from it. And I wonder if maybe that has something to do with the underappreciation of Camus' work, that for a lot of people, The Outsider is their introduction to Camus. And I'm not sure it's an ideal entry point.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think as a little 17-year-old romanticist, I really quite like the pathos. I didn't really understand a lot of what was going on, but I found Meff so oddly comic and endearing, I must say. And there is an absurdity about the whole thing, right? You know, he kills somebody senselessly. He's put on trial mainly because he doesn't, and condemned mainly because he doesn't cry at his mother's funeral. But, you know, there are a lot of other dimensions that are going on in the background of that text because the guy he kills is an Arab and, you know, it's a Pinoir Algerian killing an Arab on the beach senselessly who has no name, And so there's a lot of colonial dynamics going on in that text as well, which, of course, at 17, I had no idea about.
I think I read it at 15, and the pinnacle of Western literature at that point for me was Oscar Wilde. So I was definitely not ready for Camus.
He's a little different from Wilde, but yeah, Wilde's a pinnacle, definitely.
Matthew Sharp. He's a lecturer and researcher in the School of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne, and his book, Why Albert Camus Matters, will be available from February. Publication details on the website. That's the Philosopher's Zone, and you can also find us via ABC Listen. The Philosopher's Zone is produced on Bundjalung Country by me, David Rutledge, and it's been great to have you along this week. See you next time.